This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, how to handle those roundabouts that keep popping up, a surge in bankruptcies in our province, a new simulator for the Cape Breton Miners Museum, and the business of making kilts. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. Get used to them because there's more on the way. What, you ask? Roundabouts. They're popping up everywhere these days as the Transportation Department revamps busy intersections. Keith Bodie is a senior highway design engineer at Nova Scotia Transportation and Infrastructure Renewal. He spoke with Dialogue's Bill McCush.
So the project is to install three roundabouts over the course of the next 3 years. Starting at the entrance to what we're calling the Breton Abilities driveway. So down by the Plaza Check Mall. That'll be the first roundabout. That'll start construction this year and finish up basically by the end of construction season. The next roundabout will likely be installed similar time frame next year at Celtic Drive and Kings Road. And what will happen there is we'll have a connection back of a center median so that left turns will be prevented between those two circles. And that's really where this project gains its safety benefit. The real concern right now in Kings Road is all the left-turning traffic, and it's causing a number of safety concerns and collisions and potential challenges. So as the project advances and that median gets introduced, those left turns will be dropping out, and it'll be right turn only into each one of the businesses. So with the introduction of that second roundabout in year two of the project, so in 2021, we'll add that median. And then in the following year at Kenwood Drive and in Kings Road, you'll see the third roundabout and then the second piece of median, so from Celtic to Kenwood. And what that'll do is that'll complete the project in the third year and improve the safety of the overall corridor.
Drivers in Sydney will be making some adjustments, and the DOT has often spoken about educating the motoring public about the differences between roundabouts and intersections with traffic lights. Why is education so important, Keith?
Well, the good news about roundabouts is they're fairly straightforward. It's a yield situation. You want to yield to everyone in the circle. So when you approach the roundabout, you want to make sure you're in the correct lane. And that's the real piece here that people have to get used to, unlike some of the other roundabouts that are sort of a single lane approach. So if you're going to come into the roundabout and you need to make that all important U-turn to get back down to the other side of the road, or you need to make a left-hand turn, you want to be in the left lane. If you want to drive through the roundabout or turn right, you'd be in the right lane. And it's as simple as that. Right and through in the right lane, left, and U-turn in the left lane. So it's going to be signed. It's something that, you know, we anticipate drivers are going to need some guidance, so we're going to provide signage for those operations and destinations. And what we like people to do, and we always recommend, is if you're at all concerned as a driver, if you have any issue, you want to make sure that you're comfortable for that Monday morning commute, or you know how to get where you want to go, go and practice in a quieter time. Wait for a Sunday morning or Sunday just before lunchtime or something like that. When it's a little quieter out on the streets, go out and practice your route. Make sure that you're comfortable with it before things get busy. We don't want to see you try it Monday morning for the first time in the height of traffic and everybody's trying to, you know, go every different direction and things. So that's really the key, is to get used to things. And after that second or third trip through, we're comfortable that it's going to be old news. You know, it's something that drivers have gotten used to the world over, and we trust in the people at Cape Breton.
Sure. As far as safety the world over, as you mentioned, are there jurisdictions where safety has been improved when it comes to a roundabout versus an intersection with traffic lights?
Sure. I mean, I don't get into a lot of statistical discussion because it's just numbers, and numbers can be used in different ways. But what has been shown is that when a circular intersection with a raised median gets put in, the safety of the corridor is improved. And it's improved because you're limiting the movements of the vehicles to those that are not as challenging from a T-bone or a head-on collision perspective, which are the real serious collisions for injuries. So if you eliminate those, or you limit those to very few opportunities, what ends up happening is that all of the users of the corridor become safer. People are slowing down, things are operating in a much more smooth, efficient way, and the drivers and the pedestrians and all the other users are able to focus more on the task at hand, which is driving and using the corridor. So what ends up happening is your safety is improved that way. Statistically, if a person wanted to go out and dig up all those numbers, I know they prove it out. We study these things year in, year out, and you know the safety performance is unparalleled.
Can you talk, Keith, if you don't mind, about some of the discussions people have with the province about their frustration before they get used to the roundabouts? What are the major concerns when they anticipate this new infrastructure in their communities?
I've been spending years going out into the public and chatting about roundabouts, and remarkably, I think what ends up happening is anyone who's used one understands, you know, the slowdown to get around, the yield on entry, and getting yourself in the correct lane. And after one or two uses, everyone's kind of got that expertise they need. It's not something, it's a fear of the unknown, as it were. It's a fear of kind of change. And you know, everyone has that within them. And it's just a matter of finding a way to overcome that and to put yourself in a position of having a little bit more of that expertise. That's why we recommend that Sunday morning exercise. Get out there when there's not that many people, and then get used to it. Because really, like anything else, once you're used to it, it takes away that fear.
When you exit or enter a roundabout, are there times when you must signal? In other words, do you signal when you enter a roundabout, or do you use your signal light when you exit?
Sure. I guess the real key here is to follow the traffic laws of Nova Scotia. And, you know, there is recommendation to signal your exits, and that is... It's not mandated, but it's something that is a good practice because it signals your intent to other drivers as to what you're about to do. It's a good practice to be in to signal that intent and say, you know what, I'm leaving the roundabout now. I'm going to go right, or I'm going to go, you know, whichever direction, and I'm going to travel down this leg, as it were. So yeah, certainly signaling your intent to depart is not a bad thing, and you know, we all must follow the laws of the land. If there's a requirement to signal based on a lane change or any of those other issues, then by all means that has to be followed.
If we can switch, if you don't mind, to the roundabout slated for Waikaugama, what can the motoring public expect when it comes to the work being done in Waikaugama?
The roundabout in Waikaugama is being introduced adjacent to the business known as the Farmer's Daughter. They're a very well-known local establishment, extremely busy throughout the summer months. And the roundabout will be adjacent to their business. So at the existing crossroads that's there now, anybody that knows the area knows that there's some challenges with visibility and seeing across, and there's some safety concern there with respect to speeds. So the roundabout is an ideal kind of solution with respect to reducing those speeds and to improve the visibility of the vehicles using the intersection. So the introduction of that adjacent there is definitely a safety tool, and we'll see improved operation of that intersection on top of that. So as far as construction timing, I understand that we're hoping to get out early this spring with a construction tender with a view to having the project constructed before the July season, before tour season, so that it's constructed in advance business operations during peak season. Now, if that's not possible, there are things that can be done with various, you know, night works or delaying the tender so that it's done in the fall or quieter times of the year. So there's different things that our construction team will do to approach that tender and ensure, you know, we can't ensure that there won't be any impact, but we'll try and minimize impact to local businesses as much as possible.
Do you think there will come a time when traffic lights will become obsolete to make way for more roundabouts in communities?
Roundabouts, much like traffic signals, are a tool for a specific purpose. We don't see one tool solving all issues at all times. And it's important to understand that, you know, every time we introduce something, we do a significant amount of analysis as the department, but also as engineers. We make sure that what we're proposing is the best value for the taxpayer, best value for the situation that it's in. So seeing signals disappear, I would say no, that's not likely the case. I mean, that'd be like, you know, asking if Phillips screws are going to disappear. No. When Robertson was introduced, everybody thought they were the best thing ever, but no, they're still around, and they probably always will be. And I see the same thing with roundabouts and signals. In the right context, you know, in an urban environment, downtown core, grid system, there's lots of good reasons for signals. And similarly with roundabouts, anytime you have speed control or safety issues or sight distance challenges, we see them as being a very good tool and certainly a lot of safety benefit there. So, you know, there's positives and negatives to both, and certainly as designers, engineers, and frankly civil servants, it's up to us to provide the best recommendation we can for the situation we're in.
Can you talk about the comparison of T-bone type traffic mishaps that typically occur at the intersections rather than roundabouts?
Yeah, I guess that's the real key. I mean, unfortunately, there's been a few collisions around the province in the last little while where T-bone has been a part of the collision mechanism, and it is one of the more dangerous. You know, it's a high-speed collision at a right angle, and tends to have higher incidence of injury and more severe injuries. And with a roundabout environment, you're not eliminating that possibility, but you're reducing it dramatically. And what ends up happening with that reduction of potential is that the safety goes up. And that's really what it's about, is improving the safety, lowering speeds. And with lower speeds comes a much less serious injury as well. So, you know, those two things combined, lower opportunity and lower speed, it's win-win.
How much does it cost to install a roundabout, roughly?
That's a challenging question to answer. I mean, it's like anything else. It depends on the context it's in. But generally, we're seeing a very similar cost between a traditional set of traffic signals and a roundabout. Just a little over $1 million for either one. And again, it depends on what underground works are required and how extensive the construction of the intersection is itself. So it can vary, and it can rise quite a bit, as you can imagine. I mean, the more things you add in, the more costs you'll have. So you can end up with, you know, a couple $1 million for one intersection, as, you know, depending on the context. I think the real key is for people to get out and get some exposure. There is a website available through Transportation Nova Scotia about roundabouts. There's a number of commonly asked questions there with all kinds of information from, you know, how do I drive roundabouts, to why did we plant vegetation in the middle, to, you know, what about senior drivers? Are we thinking about them? You know, all many, many, many questions answered. And the real key is for folks to just slow down and drive safe. As I say, take the time when it's not as busy. Be patient until it's built. This is something we've experienced across the province. As things are being constructed, things can be frustrating, and we understand that. But once it's built, things become clear. All the signs are installed. The paint is down. The curbing is all in. Things become a little clearer and a little bit easier to use. But the real key is to remember that the operation is simple. It's a yield sign. If any driver can handle a yield sign, they can handle a roundabout.
According to the latest statistics from the Office of the Superintendent of Bankruptcy, 13,200 Canadians filed insolvencies last October, the biggest monthly spike in a decade. The increase was 17.3% in Nova Scotia, higher than the national average. Len Shaw is Senior Vice President with BDO Debt Solutions Canada, and Dialogue spoke with him about finding solutions to debt.
When it comes to bankruptcies, insolvencies, and so on, it's kind of a worrying statement when we hear that they're at the highest level in a decade. Why is that?
That's a very good question. And last October, we saw the monthly number of insolvencies spike to the highest level for the last 10 years. That's very alarming. So we actually saw insolvency rates in all four Atlantic provinces increase in the third quarter of 2019. So that means that more people are filing insolvencies than ever before. Also, what's more alarming is that Nova Scotia has the highest rate per capita of repeat bankruptcies. So that means that people are not only going through this process once, but they're going through this process multiple times, which is alarming, and it's a sign of both a weakening economy, and it's a sign of, for Cape Breton, particularly low wages and an unstable job market and affordability issues. Affordability issues is a large one because we saw from the BDO Affordability Index study that we just held last year that more Canadians are struggling. Half of the people surveyed told us that they're living paycheck to paycheck and that they're having trouble making ends meet. One-third of people say that they don't make enough money to cover their monthly living costs and their debt costs. Half of them just have $200 left at the end of the month after everything is paid. And one-quarter of them find their debt overwhelming. So that's very alarming that people are in that kind of a state where they find their debt overwhelming and they're struggling.
Alarming as well that things don't look like they're going to improve much, do they?
Well, it's to be seen. We hope that 2020 things improve. However, signs are that the economy is still kind of staggering and still not doing great. We know that the major causes of insolvency are job loss and income reduction, which we see a lot of in Cape Breton. Illness and medical is another major factor for insolvency, and unexpected disasters like a flood or a car breakdown, any kind of situation that causes you to be financially hurt can cause a person to be find themselves in a financial difficult situation.
What does one do when one finds themselves in that situation? How do you go about correcting it?
That's a very good question. So the first thing that everyone should do, and it doesn't matter whether you're a low income earner or a high income earner, everyone needs a financial plan. It's important to gather up all your bills and find out exactly how much money you owe. It's important to assess where you're at right now financially. Look at, what are my assets? What do I owe? What can I do to improve myself financially in 2020? So one of the most important things to do is create a budget. And we hear a lot of people talk about budgets, but it really is the cornerstone fundamental thing to do. It's important for everyone to look at how much money they have coming into their household and how much money they have leaving the household. And it's important to build into your budget necessities like rent and mortgage and utility payments, groceries, all the necessities of life. That has to be built in, number one, into your budget so that those things are covered off every month. Then it's also important to build in a component for savings. It's very important that everyone has an emergency fund so that if the car does break down or something unexpected comes up, that you have some kind of an emergency fund. Thirdly, it's very important that you have some kind of component for a debt repayment into your budget. So that's what's going to help you retire or pay down that debt over a period of time. So if you look at the amount of debt you have, if it's not fitting into your budget so that you can pay that debt down in a reasonable amount of time over the next few years, then it's important to ask for help. There are ways that we can fix that, but the sooner you ask for help, the better. One option is what's called a consumer proposal, and that's basically where we take all your debt and then we combine it and consolidate it into one payment, and then we can often reduce the amount of the payback. We can stop the interest, and that person now is able to fit in, into their budget one monthly payment for that consumer proposal to deal with the debt so that it's manageable and fits into their budget. Worst case scenario is often a bankruptcy. We try to avoid that whenever possible, though. But it's important for people to know that there are ways to fix it, that these laws and programs are in place to help people. They're there to help people that find themselves on unfortunate circumstances and just want to be able to get a fresh start.
Important to make that step. If you are feeling overwhelmed, though, and you said, look, I've just reached the end, is to get hold of a professional because there is help available.
Definitely, and I see it every day. I see how people are stressed and they're worried about their financial situation. So if it gets to a point where you're not sleeping at night, you're scared to answer your phone, you're scared to open your mail, those are all signs that you need to have help. You need to ask for help, and help is out there. It's not worth your help. It's there's no way to live when you're constantly worried and anxious about your debt. Or if you're at a point where you're debating whether to pay for groceries or to heat your house or to pay for medicine, those are things that shouldn't have to be. So if you find yourself in that situation, there is help available and there's ways to fix it. It's important to know that there's always a way to fix a financial problem.
How does one get hold of BDO and get that help when needed?
Yes, you can definitely go. You can call us. We are in Glace Bay. We're in Sydney. We travel all throughout Cape Breton. Or you can. Our phone number is 902-539-9850. Or you can go to our website. It's www.debtsolutions.bdo.ca.
The Cape Breton Miners Museum will be offering a new attraction for visitors this coming tourist season. The new Mine Simulator gives people the experience of going down into a mine in a rake car. Dialogue's Dave DeVoe spoke with Museum Director Mary Pat Mumbriquet about the new feature.
It's something that we've been working on for quite some time. I mean, really, really and truthfully, back when I first started at the museum, we all got together, the staff and volunteers, and saying, you know, what can we do to make this place better? And that top of the list, no matter who you talk to, whether it was a visitor, a staff, a volunteer, or just somebody in the community, was get the simulator back. Everybody remembered when they were a kid and they would get in the rake car and it would rock and roll as they would sit in front of the movie that showcased Nipper. And so it was just something that everybody remembered fondly. So when we started doing our strategic plan, that came up consistently again. But we sort of wanted to take it into the new century. Like, what would a simulator look like now?
Why did the original one stop in the first place?
I think it broke down. Now, the guides were telling me that it was over in the Pony Barn, and we went over there looking for it, and we couldn't find all the parts, so we didn't have a clue how to put it together again. So it was that bringing that one on side again was just not going to happen.
Right.
So that's when we started planning on, okay, what are we going to do? If we know we want something like the simulator. What are we going to do to bring it into the century? And so that's when we started basically dreaming as if we had more money than we knew what to do with. So, and we came up with this plan for the virtual mine tour.
Tell us a little bit about how this new simulator is going to work. I understand it's still going to be a rake car. There's going to be woofers and sort of like wind blowing. And what are some of the other features?
So it is. It's fully encased. So you walk into, basically it looks like a little room, and in this little room is a rake car. So you get into the rake car. There'll also be two wheelchair bays. So even if your mobility is severely limited, you can still enjoy the rake car. You get in the rake car, and you there's screens in front of you and on either side of you. And as you get going in the rate card, the miner appears, Angus Miner, and he will take you through the last century of coal mining in Cape Breton, starting around the turn of the century. He'll take you down into a mine where the men are mining the way they did at the turn of the century, and he will explain a bit about coal mining at that time to you, and then you'll be able to see the men working in that era on either side of you and in front of you.
So you're going to have like this illusion of movement as you go on, like the screen will show motion and you'll have this illusion of movement. Is that the idea?
Exactly. That is exactly the idea. So so there will be the sort of illusion of movement, like you're going, and as you get into the mine, it gets darker and darker and darker until you're just the only illumination is whatever lamp he used in that period of time. So at the turn of the century, it was the Bickett lamp. So it's a very sort of it's just not much illumination at all. And then at the end of that period, there will be, I think there's a roof collapse and everything goes dark.
Oh, really?
Yes. And then you
be scary even as a simulation.
It is. It's quite exciting actually. So then the light starts to come up again as Angus lights his lamp. And this time it's a safety lamp. And then he talks, this is about 1925, 1935, in that kind of era. And he'll talk to you about coal mining during that time, and you'll be able to see the people digging mines the way they did during that time. And then again, there's a rock, something goes on with the rocks. And it goes dark again, and then he lights his lamp again, and this time we're in 1985, and he'll take us through coal mining in that general area, and that sort of little era ends with a mine explosion, and when the mine explodes, then the Ray Kirk starts going back up into the top of the mine, and then you'll see all the draggermen running down the sides of the mine as they go to do the rescue and recovery of the miners who are down there. So it's going to be really exciting. We're just thrilled with it.
So I assume there's lots of stock footage and stuff that you had to compile together.
There was an awful lot of stock footage, but there actually was an animation team that worked on this. And they built, a lot of stuff was built specifically for this. And it was, they've done a phenomenal job. So it's just amazing. So, and every step of the way, the miners here have looked at everything to make sure it's as authentic as possible.
Right, right. So this miner you're talking about, Angus the Miner, is this an animated character or is this an actor? Or
this is an actor. And when I'm talking about animation, I'm not talking about like cartoon animation.
No, yeah.
It's their interpretation of the mine, so they can get it exactly the way they want it.
I understand this is a long time coming. There have been funding issues around this. You wanted to have this going last year, but there were funding problems, but through getting some federal money and some fundraising, you managed to get it up and going this year. So tell us a little bit about the sort of the financial challenges that you faced before you were able to get this off the ground.
Well, when we first applied for funding for this, we put together a budget with the architects and the engineers and everybody, but because it had never been done before, a virtual mine tour had never been built before. So when we actually started working on it and put it out to tender, the numbers that were coming in were quite a bit higher than we had budgeted for. It was about $500,000 over budget. And that's $500,000 is a sum that no non-for-profit can come up with out of their back pocket. So it was sort of like, okay, everything stopped. And, you know, I said to the architects and the engineers and everybody, let's go back to our drawing board and figure out what we can cut to make to get this done. So everybody, we stopped work about March last year, and everybody went back to their drawing boards. And then in October, we came up with a new number. It's still over budget by close to $200,000, but we've managed to do some private fundraising and raise some money towards that. And COA's kicked in a little bit more to help with that. So we're still in the process of looking for some more money. So. We're well on our way to having everything we need to finish this build. But meanwhile, we've got the okay, and the build is ongoing. And in fact, it should be finished up in March. So we're pretty pleased and excited about this.
What other fundraising activities are going on there? I know there's the kilt initiative that's been done. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh yeah, the kilt initiative is a great initiative. So there is Red Label Kilts. Deanna Lloyd made a tartan for us. It's Absolute Darkness. It's a beautiful, beautiful tartan. And she's the first 10 kilts are being sold to raise money for the museum. So it is when those get all are sold, we'll have about $16,000, and that will go directly to helping us build the simulator. So we're pretty excited about that. We've also got the fundraising going on for the 26 Colliery Memorial. So that's ongoing as well. So we're actually a hub of fundraising over here right now.
Is the number 20, the timeline for the number 26 Memorial still as it was when first announced?
Yes, it is. I've been talking with the sculptor, and he's busy as a bee working on it right now. In fact, he sent us the pictures of the model of it, the mock-up, and it's absolutely gorgeous. I think we're all just pretty impressed with that. So it's a very exciting place to be at the museum right now.
I know, as a nonprofit, you always have expense challenges. For any private people out there that might want to contribute to your fundraising, can you say a little bit more about some of the other things? Because once the simulator gets done, I'm sure there's plenty of other needs that are going to have to be met. What are some of the other things that that raised funds will go toward?
Well, basically, when we did our strategic plan, when we wanted to create the best museum we could possibly create through our interpretive renewal, it's about a $7 million plan. This is just phase one of it, because when we got some money to do something, like we said, because top of the list for everybody was the simulator, that's what we picked to do. But there is, there's like $6 million more things that can happen here, such as programming, having programming rooms where we could do sort of bring kids in from schools and do scientific experiments or cultural programming, all kinds of interesting hands-on approaches, sort of. Do you know the Discovery Center up in Halifax?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so something like that. We'd like to have some programming rooms where the kids can come in and actually do their own sort of experiments based on the coal culture of Cape Breton.
Okay.
So we've got a vision for the future. So there is all kinds of opportunities to be part of that.
And I understand there's periodic lectures over there as well.
Yes, we do, not on a real sustained basis as of yet, but we are hoping to do more of that. We really do need the programming room to offer that sort of as a regular program.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Mary Pat, about the upcoming season, what prospective visitors might want to know?
Well, we're thrilled. Every year we're getting wonderful, wonderful comments from people that come here, so we're really pleased with that. We think we offer a wonderful experience for our visitors, and we'd really like to share that more. And with the locals as well. 85% of the people that come through our doors are from away. So we're hoping to see more locals this year that are going to take in the virtual mine tour.
And finally on our show this week, a unique business in Cape Breton that's been doing its own thing on the island for 24 years and is now expanding. Dina Loy's Red Label Kilts designs and makes traditional and custom-made kilts, plus other tartan accessories. We spoke with her about the business and its future plans.
Well, I've always been a sewer, which comes from a background of my grandmother, which taught me when I was very young. When our daughter began Highland dancing, that's when I got into doing kilt making. So I made her first kilt 24 years ago now, and just went from there. Started into a business that same year, and officially formed the business name, and been strong at it ever since.
Take us through the process, if you would. How do you start to make a kilt, and what's involved?
Well, first, it's a lot of customer feedback on what their desired colors are or their clan, and depending on whether we're doing it for a family member or a dancer, of course those tartans definitely vary, and then we go from there. We bring in the fabric and start the process from there. So a hand stitch kilt, which is what I do, traditional kilt making. Takes about 16 hours per kilt, depending on whether it's a dancer kilt or if it's a man's or a woman's kilt without a hem, then of course it's a little bit less in time. But we always like to give that hem on a dancer kilt to give them lots of growth.
So these are actually hand-stitched?
They're all hand-stitched, yeah, every stitch on them. So we don't use the machine at all on them. Every stitch right down from the interfacing and the linings and everything that's stitched into them, everything is done by hand. Every single pleat is stitched by hand.
When you sit down with the person who's buying it, then you're looking at designs and so on. What's the most popular? Do you make your own designs or the tartan that exists itself?
Yeah, I do my own designs. So I have 12 tartan designs right now, most of which are registered with the Scottish Authority in Scotland. And to sit down with a family member or a corporation or an organization to design their tartan, it is quite a detailed process where we need to figure out, what their use is going to be for the tartan and what colors represent them or their organization, and we start from there. And it's just kind of a building block around their story that they want to represent that tartan as well. And once I have all of that in place, then I sit down, and that gives me an idea of what their tartan should look like, and we start to build it from there. Is back and forth quite a bit with clients, and I'll usually submit two or three different designs to them, and then we break it down from there, what they like, what they, what they want to see more of, what they want to see less of. And it is a process. It is quite a process. It's a lot of hours involved in designing a tartan. And, it can be a six-month process.
So you said there's a Scottish registry for registering your tartan, your design?
Yes, there is, yes. And that's based in Edinburgh, Scotland. And in that building is all births, deaths, marriages, and tartans are registered there.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That would be a big registry, I would take it.
Yeah, it is. It's quite impressive. I went to visit there 2 years ago now, and I was very taken back by the size of the building, and I did get to go into the vault, which was a very rare occasion that you get to go into that vault, but they took me on a tour, and I got to see exactly where all of this was housed. So It was pretty overwhelming. It's a very large building. There's a lot of stuff registered there as far as what's with the authority in Scotland.
No, you just don't make kilts.
No, I do a lot of other things as well. So anything that can be made from a tartan once it's designed, you know, we sit down and we look at the tartan after it's designed and we say, okay, what can we make with this?
For instance, what else do you make?
Well, we have scarves woven, so that's one thing. Another big thing that we're big on is capes. You know, we're pretty much open to anything. We have a jewelry line now. We do handbags.
I saw on your Facebook page, I saw cufflinks.
Yes, we do cufflinks
as
well. Which
were tartan cufflinks, which looked pretty original.
Yeah, so that's just one of our very new items. So we just came out with that just before Christmas. So so we'll be moving in on that again this year, bigger. And we have a couple new jewelry pieces that we'll be adding as well. And that's great because not everyone wants to wear a kilt. But they want to wear their tartan. So it gives them other options and smaller, you know, options as to where they can wear it. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do is come up with some original ideas. We have a couple tartans coming out this year that'll be very original to Cape Breton and Nova Scotia.
You do have a couple out now. One, you did a tartan for the Savoy Theater, but you also did what you call a coal miner's tartan. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's a tribute to the coal miners, and I actually designed that tartan back a number of years ago and just kind of set on it, and I was actually very nervous to unveil that one and because it was about the colors and it was about getting the story right, and sat down with Steve Drake, and who was a former representative for the union, for the miners, mm-hmm. and talked with him quite a bit and got a real feeling for the story, and he helped quite a bit with that story. You know, a lot of the wording in that is his wording that surrounds that. And also when we were meeting one day and he was, you know, talking about underground, because I had to get a real feeling for underground. So when he was talking about it and he put his hand in front of his face and stopped dead and said, "It's absolute darkness." And with that, I looked at him and said, "That's the name of the tartan."
That is the name of the tartan.
Yeah, so that's what we named it, was Absolute Darkness. So that was, it was very, very emotional for me unveiling that tartan. We did it with the Men of the Deeps at the Cape Breton Miners Museum. And they were quite taken back with the tartan, and they loved it, and they're wearing it. So they all had scarves given to them just before the holidays, and with their names all embroidered on them, so they're quite proud to wear those.
With every tartan comes a storyline.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm.
And that comes either, as you said, you did that, you made, that was original, putting
yes.
that together with Steve Drake, but
yes.
the other storylines would come from years and years of tradition and history, I take it.
Yes, it absolutely did. Yes, it did.
What's the most difficult part about making a kilt?
About making a kilt? I can basically make a kilt in my sleep, so I really don't have a whole lot of difficulty with doing kilts. When it comes to tartan design, a little bit of the difficulty sometimes might be just trying to get people to open up and tell the story about what they, you know, what they really want around the tartan, and I think that if we have that from the beginning, then it makes the whole process a little bit easier. But as far as difficulty, I really don't have a whole lot of difficulty when it comes to that. It's kind of a natural thing for me.
It's just that it's a time-consuming process.
It is. It's time-consuming, yeah.
If I walk into your Red Label kilts tomorrow and say, "I want a Wilson tartan," can you provide that?
Yes, I certainly can.
And you get that through the registry and...
Yeah, well, there's several mills in Scotland that would produce that. And what I always tell people, if they don't have a tartan, we can make one for you. We can produce your own tartan.
A lot of tartans are connected to other tartans, are they not?
Some are, yes, yep.
Yeah, so yeah, you, definitely. But you would find one for sure.
Yeah, I would definitely find one. And that's what's nice about, you know, like Absolute Darkness and the Savoy Theater, you know, Dartmouth City of Lakes tartan I designed as well. Those are ones that if people do not have that Scottish background, but they're connected to a community or they're connected to an organization, they can still wear those tartans. You don't need to be Scottish to wear those tartans.
What's your average price for a kilt, let's say, these days?
On average, kilt, anywhere between $625 and $800, depending on the size and depending on the tartan. There's some tartans out there that, you know, are specialties, and they do cost a little bit more. Of course, to have your own tartan designed, then that, you know, that does cost a little bit more. There is a cost in, you know, my design fees and the registration fees. So it does cost a little bit to have your own tartan design. So. So it's going to be interesting. I'm doing a tartan for my family this year, so that's that was part of a Christmas gift to them this year. So, so it'll be an interesting process to have our own family tartan.
They say, and mostly among the Scots, they say that you're not fully dressed up unless you're in a kilt.
A kilt, or I say just a little piece of tartan. Even if it's just a little bit of tartan, then yes.
And there are lots of people who wear tartan ties and so on and so forth,
yes.
But a full regalia of kilt and jacket, socks and everything else is the ultimate dress-up piece for Scots, is it not?
Yes, it definitely is.
So you've been in business for 24 years now. Have you seen, you know, what do you see coming in your future ahead?
There's definitely, I feel, a shift in the style of the way that people are dressing up their kilts. You know, there's still, and there's always going to be your traditional look, but there's a lot of different looks that are going with kilts out there now. And so we'll be moving a little bit into that this year, into a few new designs with jackets. And we've been doing Atlantic Wedding Show in Halifax for a few years now. So we have a new look for grooms that we'll be putting on the runway this year. So I can't say too much more about that, but we're definitely seeing a shift in a little bit more less traditional.
Sounds exciting. You've also got a move coming up. You're moving away from your home-based studio.
Yes, I've been here for 24 years, so I felt that it was time to make a move and do something a little bit larger. Looking for a larger space hasn't been easy. I've been on the search for 4 years. So I've come to a compromise and taking two separate spaces this year. And so one will be in the new convent building. I have a very nice studio space there with three very large windows. So I'm looking really forward to that. We move in there in February.
You can order your kilt and watch it being made at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so people will be able to stop in there and we'll have a little corner set up for retail sales and a fitting room where people can come and, you know, have their fittings on their kilts and stuff as well. And we're also moving into the port. So we have one of the outside retail spaces for the cruise ship season. So that will be from May to the end of October.
And you can make anybody look good in a kilt. You told me that.
I can. I can make anyone look good in a kilt. I always say, you know, it's I hear people say, and I think you were one of the ones that said it, that I don't have the legs for a kilt. Everyone has the legs for a kilt.
Dina, it's great talking to you. Tell people who are listening here that how can they get in touch with Red Label Kilts?
Yeah, they can. We have a wonderful Facebook page. We're just ready to launch our web page, so we don't have that available yet. But you can reach us by, you can send us an email at redlabelkilts@gmail.com. And, yeah, you can reach us that way for now. And you can find us in the convent in February.
And that's our show for today. As always, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.